It was broken, but it grinned nonetheless. That night Hal awakened from some uneasy dream, bladder full, and got up to use the bathroom in the hall. Bill was a breathing lump of covers across the room. Hal came back, almost asleep again. And suddenly the monkey began to beat its cymbals together in the darkness. Jang, 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 jang. He came fully awake, as if snapped in the face with a cold, wet towel. His heart gave a staggering leap of surprise, and a tiny mouse-like squeak escaped his throat. He stared at the monkey, eyes wide, lips trembling. Jang, 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 jang. Its body rocked and humped on the shelf. Its lips spread and closed, hideously gleeful, revealing huge and carnivorous teeth. Stop, Hal whispered. His brother turned over and uttered a loud single snore. All else was silent, except for the monkey. The cymbals clapped and clashed, and surely it would wake his brother, his mother, the world. It would wake the dead. Jang, 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 jang. Hal moved toward it, meaning to stop it somehow. Perhaps put his hand between its cymbals until it ran down, and then it stopped on its own. The cymbals came together one last time. Jang. And then spread slowly apart to their original position. The brass glimmered in the shadows. The monkey's dirty yellowish teeth grinned. The house was silent again. His mother turned over in her bed and echoed Bill's single snore. Hal got back into his bed and pulled the covers up, his heart beating fast. And he thought, I'll put it back in the closet again tomorrow. I don't want it. But the next morning he forgot all about putting the monkey back, because his mother didn't go to work. Beulah was dead. Their mother wouldn't tell them exactly what happened. It was an accident, just a terrible accident, was all she would say. But that afternoon, Bill bought a newspaper on his way home from school and smuggled page 4 up to their room under his shirt. Bill read the article haltingly to Hal, while their mother cooked supper in the kitchen. But Hal could read the headline for himself. Two killed in apartment shootout. Beulah McCaffrey, 19, and Sally Tremont, 20, had been shot by Miss McCaffrey's boyfriend, Leonard White, 25, following an argument over who was to go out and pick up an order of Chinese food. Miss Tremont had expired at Hartford Receiving. Beulah McCaffrey had been pronounced dead at the scene. It was like Beulah just disappeared into one of her own detective magazines, Hal Shelburne thought, and felt a cold chill race up his spine and then circle his heart. And then he realized the shootings had occurred about the same time the monkey... Hal? It was Terry's voice, sleepy. Coming to bed? He spat toothpaste into the sink and rinsed his mouth. Yes, he said. He had put the monkey in his suitcase earlier and locked it up. They were flying back to Texas in 2 or 3 days, but before they went, he would get rid of the damn thing for good, somehow. You were pretty rough on Dennis this afternoon, Terry said in the dark. Dennis has needed somebody to start being rough on him for quite a while now, I think. He's been drifting. I didn't want him to start falling. Psychologically, beating the boy isn't a very productive... I didn't beat him, Terry, for Christ's sake, way to assert parental authority. Oh, don't give me any of that encounter group shit, Hal said angrily. I can see you don't want to discuss this. Her voice was cold. I told him to get the dope out of the house, too. You did? Now she sounded apprehensive. How did he take it? What did he say? Come on, Terry, what could he say? You're fired? Hal, what's the matter with you? You're not like this. What's wrong? Nothing, he said, thinking of the monkey locked away in his Samsonite. Would he hear it if it began to clap its cymbals? Yes, he surely would. Muffled but audible. Clapping doom for someone as it had for Beulah, Johnny McCabe, Uncle Will's dog Daisy. Jang, jang, jang. Is it you, Hal? I've just been under a strain. I hope that's all it is, because I don't like you this way. No. And the words escaped before he could stop them. He didn't even want to stop them. So pop a Valium and everything will look okay again. He heard her draw breath in and let it out shakily. She began to cry then. He could have comforted her, maybe, but there seemed to be no comfort in him. There was too much terror. It would be better when the monkey was gone again, gone for good, please God, gone for good. He lay wakeful until very late, until morning began to gray the air outside, but he thought he knew what to do. Bill had found the monkey the second time. That was about a year and a half after Beulah McCaffrey had been pronounced dead at the scene. It was summer. Hal had just finished kindergarten. He came in from playing and his mother called, "Wash your hands, senor. You are filthy like pig." She was on the porch drinking an iced tea and reading a book. It was her vacation. She had 2 weeks. Hal gave his hands a token pass under cold water and printed dirt on the hand towel. "Where's Bill?" "Upstairs. You tell him to clean his side of the room. It's a mess." Hal, who enjoyed being the messenger of unpleasant news in such matters, rushed up. Bill was sitting on the floor. The small down-the-rabbit-hole door leading to the back closet was ajar. He had the monkey in his hands. "That's busted," Hal said immediately. He was apprehensive, although he barely remembered coming back from the bathroom that night, and the monkey suddenly beginning to clap its cymbals. A week or so after that, he had had a bad dream about the monkey and Beulah. He couldn't remember exactly what. And he had awakened screaming, thinking for a moment that the soft weight on his chest was the monkey, that he would open his eyes and see it grinning down at him. But of course the soft weight had only been his pillow, clutched with panicky tightness. His mother came in to soothe him with a drink of water and 2 chalky orange baby aspirin, those volumes of childhood's troubled times. She thought it was the fact of Beulah's death that had caused the nightmare. So it was, but not in the way she thought. He barely remembered any of this now, but the monkey still scared him, particularly its cymbals and its teeth. "I know that," Bill said, and tossed the monkey aside. "It's stupid." It landed on Bill's bed, staring up at the ceiling, cymbals poised. Hal did not like to see it there. "You want to go down to Teddy's and get popsicles?" "I spent my allowance already," Hal said. "Besides, Mom says you gotta clean up your side of the room." "I can do that later," Bill said. "And I'll loan you a nickel if you want." Bill was not above giving Hal an Indian rope burn sometimes and would occasionally trip him up or punch him for no particular reason, but mostly he was okay. "Sure," Hal said gratefully. "I'll just put the busted monkey back in the closet first, okay?" "Nah," Bill said, getting up. "Let's go, go, go." Hal went. Bill's moods were changeable, and if he paused to put the monkey away, he might lose his popsicle. They went down to Teddy's and got them, and not just any popsicles either, but the rare blueberry ones. Then they went down to the rec where some kids were getting up a baseball game. Hal was too small to play, but he sat far out in foul territory, sucking his blueberry popsicle and chasing what the big kids called Chinese home runs. They didn't get home until almost dark, and their mother whacked Hal for getting the hand towel dirty, and whacked Bill for not cleaning up his side of the room. And after supper there was TV, and by the time all of that happened, Hal had forgotten all about the monkey. It somehow found its way up onto Bill's shelf, where it stood right next to Bill's autographed picture of Bill Boyd. And there it stayed for nearly 2 years. By the time Hal was 7, babysitters had become an extravagance, and Mrs. Shelburne's parting shot each morning was, "Bill, look after your brother." That day, however, Bill had to stay after school and Hal came home alone, stopping at each corner until he could see absolutely no traffic coming in either direction, and then skittering across, shoulders hunched, like a doughboy crossing no man's land. He let himself into the house with the key under the mat and went immediately to the refrigerator for a glass of milk. He got the bottle, and then it slipped through his fingers and crashed to smithereens on the floor, the pieces of glass flying everywhere. Jang, 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 from upstairs in their bedroom. Jang, jang, jang. "Hi, Hal. Welcome home. And by the way, Hal, is it you? Is it you this time? Are they gonna find you dead at the scene?" He stood there immobile, looking down at the broken glass and the puddle of milk, full of a terror he could not name or understand. It was simply there, seeming to ooze from his pores. He turned and rushed upstairs to their room. The monkey stood on Bill's shelf, seeming to stare at him. The monkey had knocked the autographed picture of Bill Boyd face down onto Bill's bed. The monkey rocked and grinned and beat its cymbals together. Hal approached it slowly, not wanting to, but not able to stay away. Its cymbals jerked apart and crashed together, jerked apart again. As he got closer, he could hear the clockwork running in the monkey's guts. Abruptly, uttering a cry of revulsion and terror, he swatted it from the shelf, as one might swat a bug. It struck Bill's pillow and then fell on the floor, cymbals beating together, jang, 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 lips flexing and closing as it lay there on its back in a patch of late April sunshine. Hal kicked it with one Buster Brown, kicked it as hard as he could, and this time the cry that escaped him was one of fury. The clockwork monkey skittered across the floor, bounced off the wall, and lay still. Hal stood staring at it, fists bunched, heart pounding. It grinned saucily back at him, the sun of a burning pinpoint in one glass eye. "Kick me all you want," it seemed to tell him. "I'm nothing but cogs and clockwork and a warm gear or two. Kick me all you feel like. I'm not real. Just a funny clockwork monkey is all I am. And who's dead? There's been an explosion at the helicopter plant. What's that rising up into the sky like a big bloody bowling ball, with eyes where the finger holes should be? Is it your mother's head, Hal? Whee! What a ride your mother's head is having! Or down at Brook Street Corner? Look here, pard. The car was going too fast. The driver was drunk. There's one Bill less in the world. Could you hear the crunching sound when the wheels ran over his skull and his brain squirted out his ears? Yes, no, maybe. Don't ask me. I don't know. I can't know. All I know how to do is beat these cymbals together. Jang, jang, jang. And who's dead at the scene, Hal? Your mother? Your brother? Or is it you, Hal? Is it you? He rushed at it again, meaning to stomp it, smash it, jump on it until cogs and gears flew and its horrible glass eyes rolled along the floor. But just as he reached it, its cymbals came together once more, very softly. Jang. As a spring somewhere inside expanded one final, minute notch. And a sliver of ice seemed to whisper its way through the walls of his heart, impaling it, stilling its fury, and leaving him sick with terror again. The monkey almost seemed to know. How gleeful its grin seemed. He picked it up, tweezing one of its arms between the thumb and first finger of his right hand, mouth drawn down in a bow of loathing, as if it were a corpse he held. Its mangy fake fur seemed hot and fevered against his skin. He fumbled open the tiny door that led to the back closet and turned on the bulb. The monkey grinned at him as he crawled down the length of the storage area, between boxes piled on top of boxes, past the set of navigation books, and the photograph albums with their fume of old chemicals, and the souvenirs and the old clothes, and Hal thought, "If it begins to clap its cymbals together now and move in my hand, I'll scream. And if I scream, it'll do more than grin. It'll start to laugh at me, and then I'll go crazy. And they'll find me in here drooling and laughing crazy. I'll be crazy, oh please, dear God. Please, dear Jesus, don't let me go crazy." He reached the far end and clawed two boxes aside, spilling one of them and jammed the monkey back into the Ralston Purina box in the farthest corner. And it leaned in there comfortably, as if home at last, cymbals poised, grinning its simian grin, as if the joke were still on Hal. Hal crawled backwards, sweating hot and cold, all fire and ice, waiting for the cymbals to begin. And when they began, the monkey would leap from its box and scurry beetle-like toward him, clockwork whirring, cymbals clashing madly in. And none of that happened. He turned off the light and slammed the small down-the-rabbit-hole door and leaned on it, panting. At last he began to feel a little better. He went downstairs on rubbery legs, got an empty bag, and began carefully to pick up the jagged shards and splinters of the broken milk bottle, wondering if he was going to cut himself and bleed to death. if that was what the clapping cymbals had meant. But that didn't happen either. He got a towel and wiped up the milk, and then sat down to see if his mother and brother would come home. His mother came first, asking, "Where's Bill?" In a low, colorless voice, now sure that Bill must be dead at some scene, Hal started to explain about the school play meeting, knowing that even given a very long meeting, Bill should have been home half an hour ago. His mother looked at him curiously, started to ask what was wrong, and then the door opened and Bill came in. Only it was not Bill at all, not really. This was a ghost Bill, pale and silent. "What's wrong?" Mrs. Shelburne exclaimed. "Bill, what's wrong?" Bill began to cry, and they got the story through his tears. There had been a car, he said. He and his friend Charlie Silverman were walking home together after the meeting, and the car came around Brook Street corner too fast, and Charlie had frozen. Bill had tugged Charlie's hand once, but he had lost his grip, and the car... Bill began to bray out loud, hysterical sobs, and his mother hugged him to her, rocking him. And Hal looked out on the porch and saw two policemen standing there. The squad car in which they had conveyed Bill home was standing at the curb. Then he began to cry himself, but his tears were tears of relief. It was Bill's turn to have nightmares now, dreams in which Charlie Silverman died over and over again, knocked out of his Red Ryder cowboy boots and was flipped onto the hood of the rusty Hudson Hornet the drunk had been piloting. Charlie Silverman's head and the Hudson's windshield had met with explosive force. Both had shattered. The drunk driver who owned a candy store in Milford suffered a heart attack shortly after being taken into custody. Perhaps it was the sight of Charlie Silverman's brains drying on his pants. And his lawyer was quite successful at the trial with his "This man has been punished enough" theme. The drunk was given 60 days, suspended, and lost his privilege to operate a motor vehicle in the state of Connecticut for 5 years, which was about as long as Bill Shelburne's nightmares lasted. The monkey was hidden away again in the back closet. Bill never noticed it was gone from his shelf, or if he did, he never said. Hal felt safe for a while. He even began to forget about the monkey again, or to believe it had only been a bad dream. But when he came home from school in the afternoon his mother died, it was back on his shelf, cymbals poised, grinning down at him. He approached it slowly, as if from outside himself, as if his own body had been turned into a wind-up toy at the sight of the monkey. He saw his hand reach out and take it down. He felt the nappy fur crinkle under his hand, but the feeling was muffled, mere pressure as if someone had shot him full of Novocaine. He could hear his breathing quick and dry, like the rattle of wind through straw. He turned it over and grasped the key, and years later he would think that his drugged fascination was like that of a man who puts a six-shooter with one loaded chamber against a closed and jittering eyelid and pulls the trigger. "No, don't. Let it alone. Throw it away. Don't touch it." He turned the key, and in the silence he heard a perfect, tiny series of winding-up clicks. When he let the key go, the monkey began to clap its cymbals together, and he could feel its body jerking, bend and jerk, as if it were alive. It was alive, writhing in his hand like some loathsome pygmy. And the vibration he felt through its balding brown fur was not that of turning cogs, but the beating of its heart. With a groan, Hal dropped the monkey and backed away, fingernails digging into the flesh under his eyes, palms pressed to his mouth. He stumbled over something and nearly lost his balance. Then he would have been right down on the floor with it, his bulging blue eyes looking into its glassy hazel ones. He scrambled toward the door, backed through it, slammed it, and leaned against it. Suddenly he bolted for the bathroom and vomited. It was Mrs. Stuckey from the helicopter plant who brought the news and stayed with them those first two endless nights until Aunt Ida got down from Maine. Their mother had died of a brain embolism in the middle of the afternoon. She had been standing at the water cooler with a cup of water in one hand and had crumpled as if shot, still holding the paper cup in one hand. With the other she had clawed at the water cooler and had pulled the great glass bottle of Poland water down with her. It had shattered, but the plant doctor, who came on the run, said later that he believed Mrs. Shelburne was dead before the water had soaked through the dress and her underclothes to wet her skin. The boys were never told any of this, but Hal knew anyway. He dreamed it again and again on the long nights following his mother's death. "You still have trouble getting to sleep, little brother?" Bill had asked him, and Hal supposed Bill thought all the thrashing and bad dreams had to do with their mother dying so suddenly. And that was right, but only partly right. There was the guilt, the certain deadly knowledge that he had killed his mother by winding the monkey up on that sunny after-school afternoon. When Hal finally fell asleep, his sleep must have been deep. When he awoke, it was nearly noon. Petey was sitting cross-legged in a chair across the room, methodically eating an orange section by section and watching a game show on TV. Hal swung his legs out of bed, feeling as if someone had punched him down into sleep and then punched him back out of it. His head throbbed. "Where's your mom, Petey?" Petey glanced around. "She and Dennis went shopping. I said I'd hang out here with you. You always talk in your sleep, Dad?" Hal looked at his son cautiously. "No. What did I say?" "I couldn't make it out. It scared me a little." "Well, here I am in my right mind again," Hal said, and managed a small grin. Petey grinned back, and Hal felt simple love for the boy again, an emotion that was bright and strong and uncomplicated. He wondered why he had always been able to feel so good about Petey, to feel he understood Petey and could help him, and why Dennis seemed a window too dark to look through, a mystery in his ways and habits, the sort of boy he could not understand, because he had never been that sort of boy. It was too easy to say that the move from California had changed Dennis, or that his thoughts froze. The monkey. The monkey was sitting on the windowsill, symbols poised. Hal felt his heart stop dead in his chest and then suddenly begin to gallop. His vision wavered, and his throbbing head began to ache ferociously. It had escaped from the suitcase and now stood on the windowsill, grinning at him. "Thought you got rid of me, didn't you? But you've thought that before, haven't you?" "Yes," he thought sickly. "Yes, I have." "Pete, did you take that monkey out of my suitcase?" he asked, knowing the answer already. He had locked the suitcase and had put the key in his overcoat pocket. Petey glanced at the monkey, and something, Hal thought it was unease, passed over his face. "No," he said. "Mom put it there."
"Mom did?"
"Yeah. She took it from you. She laughed."
"Took it from me? What are you talking about?"
"You had it in bed with you. I was brushing my teeth, but Dennis saw. He laughed, too. He said you looked like a baby with a teddy bear."
Hal looked at the monkey. His mouth was too dry to swallow. He'd had it in bed with him? In bed? That loathsome fur against his cheek? Maybe against his mouth? Those glaring eyes staring into his sleeping face? Those grinning teeth near his neck? On his neck? Dear God! He turned abruptly and went to the closet. The Samsonite was there, still locked. The key was still in his overcoat pocket. Behind him, the TV snapped off. He came out of the closet slowly. Peter was looking at him soberly. "Daddy, I don't like that monkey," he said, his voice almost too low to hear. "Nor do I," Hal said. Petey looked at him closely to see if he was joking and saw that he was not. He came to his father and hugged him tight. Hal could feel him trembling. Petey spoke into his ear then very rapidly, as if afraid he might not have courage enough to say it again, or that the monkey might overhear.
"It's like it looks at you. Like it looks at you no matter where you are in the room. And if you go into the other room, it's like it's looking through the wall at you. I kept feeling like it wanted me for something."
Petey shuddered. Hal held him tight. "Like it wanted you to wind it up," Hal said. Pete nodded violently.
"It isn't really broken, is it, Dad?"
"Sometimes it is," Hal said, looking over his son's shoulder at the monkey. "But sometimes it still works."
I kept wanting to go over there and wind it up. It was so quiet, and I thought, I can't. It'll wake up Daddy. But I still wanted to, and I went over, and I touched it. And I hate the way it feels. But I liked it, too. And it was like it was saying, wind me up, Petey, we'll play. Your father isn't gonna wake up. He's never gonna wake up at all. Wind me up. Wind me up. The boy suddenly burst into tears. It's bad, I know it is. There's something wrong with it. Can't we throw it out, Daddy, please?
The monkey grinned its endless grin at Hal. He could feel Petey's tears between them. Late morning sun glinted off the monkey's brass cymbals. The light reflected upward and put sunstreaks on the motel's plain white stucco ceiling. What time did your mother think she and Dennis would be back, Petey?
Around one.
He swiped at his red eyes with his shirt sleeve, looking embarrassed at his tears. But he wouldn't look at the monkey.
I turned on the TV, he whispered, and I turned it up loud.
That was all right, Petey. How would it have happened, Hal wondered. Heart attack? An embolism like my mother? What? Doesn't really matter, does it? And on the heels of that, another colder thought. Get rid of it, he says. Throw it out. But can it be gotten rid of, ever? The monkey grinned mockingly at him, its cymbals held a foot apart. Did it suddenly come to life on the night Aunt Ida died, he wondered suddenly? Was that the last sound she heard? The muffled jang, jang, jang of the monkey beating its cymbals together? Up in the black attic while the wind whistled along the drainpipe? Maybe not so crazy, Hal said slowly to his son. Go get your flight bag, Petey. Petey looked at him uncertainly. What are we gonna do? Maybe it can be got rid of. Maybe permanently, maybe just for a while. A long while or a short while. Maybe it's just gonna come back and that's all this is about. But maybe we can say goodbye to it for a long time. It took 20 years to come back this time. It took 20 years to get out of the well. We're gonna go for a ride, Hal said. He felt fairly calm, but somehow too heavy inside his skin. Even his eyeballs seemed to have gained weight. But first I want you to take your flight bag out there, by the edge of the parking lot, and find 3 or 4 good-sized rocks. Put them inside the bag and bring it back to me. Got it? Understanding flickered in Petey's eyes. All right, Daddy. Hal glanced at his watch. It was nearly 12:15. Hurry. I want to be gone before your mother gets back.
Where are we going?
To Uncle Will's and Aunt Ida's, Hal said. To the home place. Hal went into the bathroom, looked behind the toilet, and got the bowl brush leaning there. He took it back to the window and stood there with it in his hand, like a cut-rate magic wand. He looked out at Petey in his Melton shirt jacket, crossing the parking lot with his flight bag, Delta showing clearly in white letters against the blue field. A fly bumbled in an upper corner of the window, slow and stupid with the end of the warm season. Hal knew how it felt. He watched Petey hunt up 3 good-sized rocks and then start back across the parking lot. A car came around the corner of the motel, a car that was moving too fast, much too fast, and without thinking, reaching with the kind of reflex a good shortstop shows going to his right, the hand holding the brush flashed down, as if in a karate chop, and stopped. The cymbals closed soundlessly on his intervening hand, and he felt something in the air. Something like rage. The car's brakes screamed. Petey flinched back. The driver motioned to him impatiently as if what had almost happened was Petey's fault, and Petey ran across the parking lot with his collar flapping and into the motel's rear entrance. Sweat was running down Hal's chest. He felt it on his forehead like a drizzle of oily rain. The cymbals pressed coldly against his hand, numbing it. Go on, he thought grimly. Go on, I can wait all day, until hell freezes over if that's what it takes. The cymbals drew apart and came to rest. Hal heard one faint click from inside the monkey. He withdrew the brush and looked at it. Some of the white bristles had blackened as if singed. The fly bumbled and buzzed, trying to find the cold October sunshine that seemed so close. Pete came bursting in, breathing quickly, cheeks rosy.
I got 3 good ones, Dad, He broke off. Are you all right, Daddy?
Fine, Hal said. Bring the bag over. Hal hooked the table by the sofa over to the window with his foot, so it stood below the sill, and put the flight bag on it. He spread its mouth open like lips. He could see the stones Petey had collected glimmering inside. He used the toilet bowl brush to hook the monkey forward. It teetered for a moment and then fell into the bag. There was a faint jing as one of its cymbals struck one of the rocks. Dad? Daddy? Petey sounded frightened. Hal looked around at him. Something was different. Something had changed. What was it? Then he saw the direction of Petey's gaze and he knew. The buzzing of the fly had stopped. It lay dead on the windowsill. Did the monkey do that? Petey whispered. Come on, Hal said, zipping the bag shut. I'll tell you while we ride out to the home place. How can we go? Mom and Dennis took the car. Don't worry, Hal said, and ruffled Petey's hair. He showed the desk clerk his driver's license and a $20 bill. After taking Hal's Texas Instruments digital watch as collateral, the clerk handed Hal the keys to his own car, a battered AMC Gremlin. As they drove east on Route 302 toward Casco, Hal began to talk, haltingly at first, then a little faster. He began by telling Petey that his father had probably brought the monkey home with him from overseas as a gift for his sons. It wasn't a particularly unique toy. There was nothing strange or valuable about it. There must have been hundreds of thousands of wind-up monkeys in the world, some made in Hong Kong, some in Taiwan, some in Korea. But somewhere along the line, perhaps even in the dark back closet of the house in Connecticut, where the two boys had begun their growing up, something had happened to the monkey. Something bad. It might be, Hal said as he tried to coax the clerk's gremlin up past 40, that some bad things, maybe even most bad things, weren't even really awake and aware of what they were. He left it there because that was probably as much as Petey could understand. But his mind continued on its own course. He thought that most evil might be very much like a monkey, full of clockwork that you wind up. The clockwork turns, the cymbals begin to beat, the teeth grin, the stupid glass eyes laugh, or appear to laugh. He told Petey about finding the monkey, but little more. He did not want to terrify his already scared boy any more than he was already. The story thus became disjointed, not really clear. But Petey asked no questions. Perhaps he was filling in the blanks for himself, Hal thought, in much the same way that he had dreamed his mother's death over and over, although he had not been there. Uncle Will and Aunt Ida had both been there for the funeral. Afterward, Uncle Will had gone back to Maine. It was harvest time, and Aunt Ida had stayed on for 2 weeks with the boys to neaten up her sister's affairs before bringing them back to Maine. But more than that, she spent the time making herself known to them. They were so stunned by their mother's sudden death that they were nearly comatose. When they couldn't sleep, she was there with warm milk. When Hal woke at 3 in the morning with nightmares, nightmares in which his mother approached the water cooler without seeing the monkey that floated and bobbed in its cool sapphire depths, grinning and clapping its cymbals, each converging pair of sweeps leaving trails of bubbles behind. She was there when Bill came down with first a fever and then a rash of painful mouth sores and then hives 3 days after the funeral. She was there. She made herself known to the boys. And before they rode the bus from Hartford to Portland with her, both Bill and Hal had come to her separately and wept on her lap while she held them and rocked them, and the bonding began. The day before they left Connecticut for good to go down Maine, as it was called in those days, the ragman came in his old ratty truck and picked up the huge pile of useless stuff that Bill and Hal had carried out to the sidewalk from the back closet. When all the junk had been set out by the curb for pickup, Aunt Ida had asked them to go through the back closet again and pick out any souvenirs or remembrances that they wanted specially to keep. "We just don't have room for it all, boys," she told them, and Hal supposed Bill had taken her at her word and had gone through all those fascinating boxes their father had left behind one final time. Hal did not join his older brother. Hal had lost his taste for the back closet. A terrible idea had come to him during those first 2 weeks of mourning. Perhaps his father hadn't just disappeared or run away because he had an itchy foot and had discovered marriage wasn't for him. Maybe the monkey had gotten him. When he heard the ragman's truck roaring and farting and backfiring its way down the block, Hal nerved himself, snatched the monkey from his shelf where it had been since the day his mother died. He had not dared to touch it until then, not even to throw it back into the closet, and ran downstairs with it. Neither Bill nor Aunt Ida saw him. Sitting on top of a barrel filled with broken souvenirs and moldy books was the Ralston Purina carton filled with similar junk. Hal had slammed the monkey back into the box it had originally come out of, hysterically daring it to begin clapping its cymbals. "Go on, go on, I dare you, double dare you." But the monkey only waited there, leaning back nonchalantly, as if expecting a bus, grinning its awful, knowing grin. Hal stood by, a small boy in old corduroy pants and scuffed Buster Browns, as the ragman, an Italian gent, who wore a crucifix and whistled through the space in his teeth, began loading boxes and barrels in an ancient truck with wooden stake sides. Hal watched as he lifted both the barrel and the Ralston Purina box balanced atop it. He watched the monkey disappear into the bed of the truck. He watched as the ragman climbed back into the cab, blew his nose mightily into the palm of his hand, wiped his hand with a huge red handkerchief, and started the truck's engine with a roar and a blast of oily blue smoke. He watched the truck draw away, and a great weight had dropped away from his heart. He actually felt it go. He had jumped up and down twice as high as he could jump, his arms spread, palms held out, and if any of the neighbors had seen him, they would have thought it odd, almost to the point of blasphemy, perhaps. Why is that boy jumping for joy? For that was surely what this was. A jump for joy can hardly be disguised. They surely would have asked themselves, with his mother not even a month in her grave? He was doing it because the monkey was gone, gone forever. Or so he had thought. Not 3 months later, Aunt Ida had sent him up into the attic to get boxes of Christmas decorations. And as he crawled around looking for them, getting the knees of his pants dusty, he had suddenly come face to face with it again, and his wonder and terror had been so great that he had to bite sharply into the side of his hand to keep from screaming or fainting dead away. There it was, grinning its toothy grin, cymbals poised a foot apart and ready to clap, leaning nonchalantly back against one corner of a Ralston Purina carton as if waiting for a bus, seeming to say, "Thought you got rid of me, didn't you? But I'm not that easy to get rid of, Hal. I like you, Hal. We were made for each other. Just a boy and his pet monkey. A couple of good old buddies. And somewhere south of here, there's a stupid old Italian ragman, lying in a claw-footed tub, with his eyeballs bulging, and his dentures half popped out of his mouth, his screaming mouth. A ragman who smells like a burned-out Exide battery. He was saving me for his grandson, Hal. He put me on the bathroom shelf with his soap and his razor and his Burma shave and the Philco radio he listened to the Brooklyn Dodgers on. And I started to clap. And one of my cymbals hit that old radio and into the tub it went. And then I came to you, Hal. I worked my way along the country roads at night and the moonlight shone off my teeth at 3 in the morning. And I left many people dead at many scenes. I came to you, Hal. I'm your Christmas present. So wind me up. Who's dead? Is it Bill? Is it Uncle Will? Is it you, Hal? Is it you?" Hal had backed away, grimacing madly, eyes rolling, and nearly fell going downstairs. He told Aunt Ida he hadn't been able to find the Christmas decorations. It was the first lie he had ever told her. And she had seen the lie in his face, but had not asked him why he had told it, thank God. And later, when Bill came in, she asked him to look, and he brought the Christmas decorations down. Later, when they were alone, Bill hissed at him he was a dummy who couldn't find his own ass with both hands and a flashlight. Hal said nothing. Hal was pale and silent, only picking at his supper. And that night, he dreamed of the monkey again, one of its cymbals striking the Philco radio, as it babbled out Dean Martin, singing "When did the moon hit your eye like a big pizza pie at Samore?" The radio tumbling into the bathtub as the monkey grinned and beat its cymbals together with a jang, and a jang, and a jang. Only it wasn't the Italian ragman who was in the tub when the water turned electric. It was him. Hal and his son scrambled down the embankment behind the home place to the boathouse that jutted out over the water on its old pilings. Hal had the flight bag in his right hand. His throat was dry. His ears were attuned to an unnaturally keen pitch. The bag was very heavy. "Hal, set down the flight bag. Don't touch that," he said. Hal felt in his pockets for the ring of keys Bill had given him, and found one neatly labeled "Bee House" on a scrap of adhesive tape. The day was clear and cold, windy, the sky a brilliant blue. The leaves of the trees that crowded up to the verge of the lake had gone every bright fall shade from blood red to school bus yellow. They talked in the wind. Leaves swirled around Petey's sneakers as he stood anxiously by, and Hal could smell November just downwind, with winter crowding close behind it. The key turned in the padlock, and he pulled the swing doors open. Memory was strong. He didn't even have to look to kick down the wooden block that held the door open. The smell in here was all summer, canvas and bright wood, a lingering, lusty warmth. Uncle Will's rowboat was still here, the oars neatly shipped, as if he had last loaded it with his fishing tackle and 2 6-packs of Black Label yesterday afternoon. Bill and Hal had both gone out fishing with Uncle Will many times, but never together. Uncle Will maintained the boat was too small for three. The red trim, which Uncle Will had touched up each spring, was now faded and peeling, though, and spiders had spun silk in the boat's bow. Hal laid hold of the boat and pulled it down the ramp to the little shingle of beach. The fishing trips had been one of the best parts of his childhood with Uncle Will and Aunt Ida. He had a feeling that Bill felt much the same. Uncle Will was ordinarily the most taciturn of men, but once he had the boat positioned to his liking, some 60 or 70 yards offshore, lines set and bobbers floating on the water, he would crack a beer for himself and one for Hal, who rarely drank more than half of the one can Uncle Will would allow, always with the ritual admonition from Uncle Will that Aunt Ida must never be told, because she would shoot me for a stranger if she knew I was giving you boys beer, don't you know? And wax expensive. He would tell stories, answer questions, rebait Hal's hook when it needed rebaiting, and the boat would drift where the wind and the mild current wanted it to be. "How come you never go out right in the middle, Uncle Will?" Hal had asked once. "Look overside there," Uncle Will had answered. Hal did. He saw the blue water and his fish line going down into black. "You're looking into the deepest part of Crystal Lake," Uncle Will said, crunching his empty beer can in one hand and selecting a fresh one with the other. 100 feet if she's an inch. Amos Culligan's old Studebaker is down there somewhere. Damn fool took it out on the lake one early December before the ice was made. Lucky to get out of it alive, he was. They'll never get that stud out, nor see it until Judgment Trump blows. Lake's one deep son of a whore right here it is. Big ones are right here, Hal. No need to go out no further. Let's see how your worm looks. Reel that son of a whore right in. Hal did, and while Uncle Will put a fresh crawler from the old Crisco tin that served as his bait box on his hook, he stared into the water, fascinated, trying to see Amos Culligan's old Studebaker, all rust and water weed drifting out of the open driver's side window, through which Amos had escaped at the absolute last moment. Waterweed festooning the steering wheel like a rotting necklace. Waterweed dangling from the rearview mirror and drifting back and forth in the currents like some strange rosary. But he could see only blue shading to black, and there was the shape of Uncle Will's nightcrawler, the hook hidden inside its knots, hung up there in the middle of things, its own sun-shafted version of reality. Hal had a brief, dizzying vision of being suspended over a mighty gulf, and he had closed his eyes for a moment until the vertigo passed. That day, he seemed to recollect, he had drunk his entire can of beer. The deepest part of Crystal Lake, 100 feet if she's an inch. He paused a moment, panting, and looked up at Petey, still watching anxiously. You want some help, Daddy? In a minute. He had his breath again, and now he pulled the rowboat across the narrow strip of sand to the water, leaving a groove. The paint had peeled, but the boat had kept under cover, and it looked sound. When he and Uncle Will went out, Uncle Will would pull the boat down the ramp, and when the bow was afloat, he would clamber in, grab an oar to push with, and say, "Push me off, Hal. This is where you earn your truss." "Hand that bag in, Petey, and then give me a push," he said, and smiling a little, he added, "This is where you earn your truss." Petey didn't smile back. "Am I coming, Daddy?" "Not this time. Another time. I'll take you out fishing, but not this time." Petey hesitated. The wind tumbled his brown hair, and a few yellow leaves, crisp and dry, wheeled past his shoulders and landed at the edge of the water, bobbing like boats themselves. "You should have stuffed him," he said low. "What?" But he thought he understood what Petey had meant. "Put cotton over the cymbals, taped it on, so it couldn't make that noise." Hal suddenly remembered Daisy coming toward him, not walking but lurching, and how quite suddenly blood had burst from both of Daisy's eyes in a flood that soaked her ruff and pattered down on the floor of the barn, how she had collapsed on her forepaws. And on the still, rainy spring air of that day, he had heard the sound, not muffled but curiously clear, coming from the attic of the house 50 feet away. Jang, 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 jang. He had begun to scream hysterically, dropping the armload of wood he had been getting for the fire. He ran for the kitchen to get Uncle Will, who was eating scrambled eggs and toast, his suspenders not even over his shoulders yet. "She was an old dog, Hal," Uncle Will had said. His face haggard and unhappy, he looked old himself. "She was 12, and that's old for a dog. You mustn't take on now. Old Daisy wouldn't like that." "Old," the vet had echoed. But he had looked troubled all the same, because dogs don't die of explosive brain hemorrhages, even at 12. "Like as if someone had stuck a firecracker in her head," Hal overheard the vet saying to Uncle Will, as Uncle Will dug a hole in the back of the barn, not far from the place where he had buried Daisy's mother in 1950. "I never seen the beat of it, Will." And later, terrified, almost out of his mind but unable to help himself, Hal had crept up to the attic. "Hello, Hal. How you doing?" The monkey grinned from its shadowy corner. Its cymbals were poised, a foot or so apart. The sofa cushion Hal had stood on end between them was now all the way across the attic. Something, some force, had thrown it hard enough to split its cover, and stuffing foamed out of it. "Don't worry about Daisy," the monkey whispered inside his head, its glassy hazel eyes fixed on Hal Shelburne's wide blue ones. "Don't worry about Daisy. She was old, Hal. Even the vet said so. And by the way, did you see the blood coming out of her eyes, Hal? Wind me up, Hal. Wind me up. Let's play. And who's dead, Hal? Is it you?" And when he came back to himself, he had been crawling toward the monkey as if hypnotized. One hand had been outstretched to grasp the key. He scrambled backward then and almost fell down the attic stairs in his haste. Probably would have if the stairwell had not been so narrow. A little whining noise had been coming from his throat. Now he sat in the boat looking at Petey. "Muffling the cymbals doesn't work," he said. "I tried it once." Petey cast a nervous glance at the flight bag. "What happened, Daddy?" "Nothing I want to talk about now," Hal said, "and nothing you want to hear about. Come on and give me a push." Petey bent to it, and the stern of the boat grated along the sand. Hal dug in with an oar, and suddenly that feeling of being tied to the earth was gone, and the boat was moving lightly. Its own thing again after years in the dark boathouse, rocking on the light waves. Hal unshipped the other oar and clicked the oar lock shut. "Be careful, Daddy," Petey said. "This won't take long," Hal promised. But he looked at the flight bag and wondered. He began to row, bending to the work. The old familiar ache in the small of his back and between his shoulder blades began. The shore receded. Petey was magically 8 again, 6, a 4-year-old, standing at the edge of the water. He shaded his eyes with one infant hand. Hal glanced casually at the shore, but would not allow himself to actually study it. It had been nearly 15 years, and if he studied the shoreline carefully, he would see the changes rather than the similarities and become lost. The sun beat on his neck, and he began to sweat. He looked at the flight bag, and for a moment he lost the bend-and-pull rhythm. The flight bag seemed to be bulging. He began to row faster. The wind gusted, drying the sweat and cooling his skin. The boat rose and the bow slapped water to either side when it came down. Hadn't the wind freshened just in the last minute or so? And was Petey calling something? Yes. Hal couldn't make out what it was over the wind. It didn't matter. Getting rid of the monkey for another 20 years, or maybe, please God, forever. Forever. That was what mattered. The boat reared and came down. He glanced left and saw baby whitecaps. He looked shoreward again and saw Hunter's Point and a collapsed wreck that must have been the Burden's boathouse when he and Bill were kids. Almost there, then. Almost over the spot where Amos Culligan's famous Studebaker had plunged through the ice one long ago December. Almost over the deepest part of the lake. Petey was screaming something, screaming and pointing. Hal still couldn't hear. The rowboat rocked and rolled, flatting off clouds of thin spray to either side of its peeling bow. A tiny rainbow glowed in one, was pulled apart. Sunlight and shadow raced across the lake in shudders, and the waves were not mild now. The whitecaps had grown up. His sweat had dried to goose flesh, and spray had soaked the back of his jacket. He rowed grimly, eyes alternating between the shoreline and the flight bag. The boat rose again, this time so high that for a moment the left oar pawed at the air instead of water. Petey was pointing at the sky, his scream now only a faint, bright runner of sound. Hal looked over his shoulder. The lake was a frenzy of waves. It had gone a deadly dark shade of blue, sewn with white seams. A shadow raced across the water toward the boat, and something in its shape was familiar, so terribly familiar, that Hal looked up, and then the scream was there, struggling in his tight throat. The sun was behind the cloud, turning it into a hunched, working shape, with two gold-edged crescents held apart. Two holes were torn in one end of the cloud, and sunshine poured through in two shafts. As the cloud crossed over the boat, the monkey's cymbals, barely muffled by the flight bag, began to beat. Jang, 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 jang. It's you, Hal. It's finally you. You're over the deepest part of the lake now, and it's your turn, your turn, your turn. All the necessary shoreline elements had clicked into their places. The rotting bones of Amos Culligan Studebaker lay somewhere below. This was where the big ones were. This was the place. Hal shipped the oars to the locks in one quick jerk, leaned forward, unmindful of the wildly rocking boat, and snatched the flight bag. The cymbals made their wild pagan music. The bag's sides bellowed, as if with tenebrous respiration. "Right here, you son of a whore," Hal screamed. "Right here!" He threw the bag over the side. It sank fast. For a moment he could see it going down, sides moving, and for that endless moment he could still hear the cymbals beating. And for a moment the black water seemed to clear, and he could see down into the terrible gulf of waters, to where the big ones lay. There was Amos Culligan Studebaker, and Hal's mother was behind its slimy wheel, a grinning skeleton, with a lake bass staring coldly from one fleshless eye socket. Uncle Will and Aunt Ida lolled beside her, and Aunt Ida's gray hair trailed upward as the bag fell, turning over and over, a few silver bubbles trailing up. Jang, 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 jang. Hal slammed the oars back into the water, scraping blood from his knuckles, and ah, God, the back of Amos Culligan Studebaker had been full of dead children. Charlie Silverman, Johnny McCabe. and began to bring the boat about. There was a dry pistol shot crack between his feet, and suddenly clear water was welling up between two boards. The boat was old. The wood had shrunk a bit, no doubt. It was just a small leak, but it hadn't been there when he rowed out. He would have sworn to it. The shore and the lake changed places in his view. Petey was at his back now. Overhead, that awful simian cloud was breaking up. Hal began to row. 20 seconds was enough to convince him he was rowing for his life. He was only a so-so swimmer, and even a great one would have been put to the test in this suddenly angry water. Two more boards suddenly shrank apart with that pistol shot sound. More water poured into the boat, dousing his shoes. There were tiny metallic snapping sounds that he realized were nails breaking. One of the oarlocks snapped and flew off into the water. Would the swivel itself go next? The wind now came from his back, as if trying to slow him down or even drive him into the middle of the lake. He was terrified, but he felt a crazy kind of exhilaration through the terror. The monkey was gone for good this time. He knew it somehow. Whatever happened to him, the monkey would not be back to draw a shadow over Dennis's life or Petey's. The monkey was gone, perhaps resting on the roof of the hood of Amos Culligan's Studebaker at the bottom of Crystal Lake, gone for good. He rowed, bending forward and rocking back. That cracking, crimping sound came again, and now the rusty Crisco can that had been lying in the bow of the boat was floating in 3 inches of water. Spray blew in Hal's face. There was a louder snapping sound, and the bow seat fell in 2 pieces and floated next to the bait box. A board tore off the left side of the boat, and then another, this one at the waterline, tore off at the right. Hal rowed. Breath rasped in his mouth, hot and dry, and then his throat swelled with a coppery taste of exhaustion. His sweaty hair flew. Now a crack zipped directly up the bottom of the rowboat, zigzagged between his feet, and ran up to the bow. Water gushed in. He was in water up to his ankles, then to the swell of calf. He rowed, but the boat's shoreward movement was sludgy now. He didn't dare look behind him to see how close he was getting. Another board tore loose. The crack running up the center of the boat grew branches like a tree. Water flooded in. Hal began to make the oars sprint, breathing in great failing gasps. He pulled once, twice, and on the third pull both oar swivels snapped off. He lost one oar, held on to the other. He rose to his feet and began to flail at the water with it. The boat rocked, almost capsized, and spilled him back onto his seat with a thump. Moments later, more boards tore loose, the seat collapsed, and he was lying in the water which filled the bottom of the boat, astounded at its coldness. He tried to get on his knees, desperately thinking, Petey must not see this, must not see his father drown right in front of his eyes. You're going to swim, dog paddle if you have to, but do something. There was another splintering crack, almost a crash, and he was in the water, swimming for the shore as he had never swum in his life. And the shore was amazingly close. A minute later he was standing waist-deep in water, not 5 yards from the beach. Petey splashed toward him, arms out, screaming and crying and laughing. Hal started toward him and floundered. Petey chest-deep floundered. They caught each other. Hal, breathing in great winded gasps, nevertheless hoisted the boy into his arms and carried him up to the beach, where both of them sprawled, panting. Daddy, is it gone? That nasty bad monkey? Yes, I think it's gone. For good this time. The boat fell apart. It just fell apart all around you. Hal looked at the boards floating loose in the water 40 feet out. They bore no resemblance to the tight handmade rowboat he had pulled out of the boathouse. It's all right now, Hal said, leaning back on his elbows. He shut his eyes and let the sun warm his face. Did you see the cloud? Petey whispered. Yes, but I don't see it now. Do you? They looked at the sky. There were scattered white puffs here and there, but no large dark cloud. It was gone, as he had said. Hal pulled Petey to his feet. There'll be towels up at the house. Come on. He paused, looking at his son.
You were crazy running out there like that.
Petey looked at him solemnly. You were brave, Daddy.